Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Well, it is just past 10 a.m. Pacific time, but it looks like it is 6 a.m. The entire house is dark. The sky is an eerie orange-red color. Roger Gass, the National Weather Service meteorologist, told the San Francisco Chronicle that, of course, fires are to blame, but it's not a specific fire. Since August, more than two dozen fires have burned in California, with dozens more in Oregon and Washington state, and they are all spewing smoke into the skies. He said, quote, "We have to think in the grand scheme. It's not just the fires in our backyard that affects the smoke over us. We're talking about so much smoke in the atmosphere." And that reminds us, we did a show about air quality a couple of weeks ago. Scientists are learning more about how smoke affects our overall health. And you can find that show at yourcallradio.org. It is only the second week of September, and wildfires have already burned more than 2 million acres in California this year, setting a state record since at least the 1970s. Over the weekend, we saw very high temperatures hit California, Nevada, Arizona, Oregon, and Washington. Here in the Bay Area, more than 10 cities hit very high, dangerous record temperatures. The record heat wave, along with the wildfires, is straining California's electrical grid and threatened power outages. At least 172,000 people had their power shut off by PG&E. Scientists say the climate crisis makes extreme weather events more likely and severe. We must act. Here in California, we are on the front lines. Today, we're joined by Professor Michael Mann, a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State, with joint appointments in the Department of Geosciences and the Earth and Environmental Systems Institute. Professor Mann is also director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center and author of several books, including The Madhouse Effect. His forthcoming book, The New Climate War, comes out in January. Hi, Professor Mann. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rose. It's good to be with you.
Well, what a wild time to have you back, Professor Mann, because as I said, I was just walking around the house. It's completely dark. I mean, it is so eerie right now. I don't think I've ever experienced anything like this.
Yeah, well, I did experience something like what you're describing earlier this year when I was on sabbatical in Sydney during what they now call the Black Summer of 2019 and 2020 down under, when Sydney was literally filled with smoke from the record bushfires, as they call them down there, that were spreading out across the continent. And indeed, I was sort of stuck in my apartment for days on end when it was unsafe to go outside because of the air quality, when smoke filled the air. And again, you know, the city of Sydney took on that same sort of haunting orange hue that you are seeing right now in California. And it's the same phenomenon. Unprecedented heat and drought last summer in Australia gave them unprecedented wildfires. We're seeing exactly the same thing happen in California, as we've long warned, we would see if we continue to warm the planet by polluting the atmosphere with carbon dioxide, with carbon pollution.
And Professor Mann, what's scary about this is the very beginning of our fire season. We still have a couple months to go.
Yeah, well, I have argued before, and I would argue again, that California no longer has a fire season. California is a fire season. Wildfires, massive wildfires, can happen any time of the year. And indeed, the largest wildfire on record, the Camp Fire a couple of years ago, occurred during the winter. So we are, you know, we'd call it a new normal, but the problem is it only continues to get worse if we continue to warm up the planet. But the reality we're dealing with now is that wildfires can happen any time of the year in California. What we might call the wildfire season, at the very least, has gotten wider and wider and wider. And now, ironically, the fire seasons in California and Australia now overlap. They never did that before. The two seasons happen at opposite times of the year in the southern and northern hemisphere, but the fire seasons have become so broad that they're literally overlapping in Australia and California, which is problematic because it means that a lot of the aircraft that might be needed to fight the fires here in California are needed at the same time in Australia and vice versa.
And as you said, Professor Mann, you and many others have been sounding the alarm bells for years. I mean, we've had you on the show many times talking about these issues. We've had fire officials say, this is our new norm. We need to truly tackle the climate crisis. So given that so much is happening at the same time, extreme heat, droughts, fires, and then in Denver, they're now undergoing a snowstorm just 2 days after the city hit 101. How are you explaining how the climate crisis fuels these extreme weather events?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, as they say, it's complicated at some level, but it's actually simple at another level. When it comes to the wildfires that we're seeing in California and Australia and in larger parts of the world, you know, it's not rocket science. You make the planet warmer, you have more extreme heat. You dry out the subtropics and the mid-latitudes, and that has to do with the changing nature of the large-scale circulation of the atmosphere. So you've got warmer and drier conditions, and you put that together, you've got more fuel for these massive wildfires. You get wildfires that are larger in extent, burn hotter, spread faster, and become more intense. And that's what we're seeing. Now, you allude to something else that's going on, the sort of wacky weather where it's hot and dry in California, and it was very hot and dry in Colorado, but now the jet stream has sort of crashed down and brought this Arctic air mass into Colorado, and they saw temperatures plummet from the 90s to the 30s in a matter of hours. Now, there too, we may be seeing the impact of climate change. It's a bit more subtle. But some of my own research, in fact, in recent years has involved investigating and trying to understand how climate change is influencing the pattern of our jet stream. And there's increasing evidence that it's giving us sort of a more wavy jet stream and a slower jet stream. So you get these big high and low pressure centers associated with extreme weather, and they sit over the same location for days on end. And what we have right now is this high pressure. It's associated with heat and dryness that has been sitting over California, creating the conditions for these wildfires. And, you know, at the same time, further east, you had a very persistent low pressure, a lot of rainfall this summer here in the eastern U.S. So we do think that climate change is influencing this sort of wacky extreme weather. And here's a note of caution. The climate models don't actually resolve this very well. They don't do a good job in capturing these changes in jet stream behavior that we're actually seeing. So when people say, well, you know, the climate models, we shouldn't trust them, they exaggerate the problem. If anything, ironically, the climate models are tending to underestimate the impact that climate change is having on these disastrous weather extremes that we see playing out now in real time.
Let's also talk about the so-called extreme weather compound climate events. These are predicted to get worse if we continue down this path. So talk about these events, like extreme heat and wildfires happening at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. So, and again, it ties into both of these factors. Look, you make the subtropics and the mid-latitudes hotter and drier, you're going to get more of this extreme heat and drought and wildfires. And that's true around the northern hemisphere. It's true around the southern hemisphere. But you also get these wacky changes, as I alluded to, in the jet stream that lead to very large sort of correlated extreme weather events around the northern hemisphere, where one region may be very hot and dry, another region may be getting record rainfall. And it has to do with the fact that the jet stream is getting slower and wavier. So you get extremes of both sides playing out simultaneously in different parts of the planet. And I already alluded to one real challenge that creates. When you have multiple weather extremes playing out, when you have wildfires breaking out across the northern hemisphere and even at the same time in the southern hemisphere, then that really starts to tax our you know, our resources, our resilience, the infrastructure that we have to deal with these sorts of extremes. Literally, we've got planes flying, trying to put out these fires in California when they're actually needed at the same time all the way down in Australia. And that's true writ large. The fact that we see these correlated weather extremes, simultaneous weather extremes, really puts a huge stress on our infrastructure, on our adaptive capacity, at a time when it's already challenged, of course, by an unprecedented pandemic.
Exactly. I want to give out the phone number because Professor Michael Mann, he really is in the thick of all of this, studying the climate crisis and its connection to extreme weather events. If you have any questions for Professor Mann, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet a question or comment at yourcallradio. Let's talk about, we touched on this earlier, but these records that are being set. Lynn Tolmachoff, a spokeswoman for CAL FIRE, said the most striking thing about these records are how early they are being set. The previous record was in 2018, according to CAL FIRE, which began tracking numbers in 1987. At least 22 large fires are still actively burning, according to the Chronicle's fire map and tracker. I mean, Professor Mann, a lot of people in the last 2 weeks have been saying, what's it going to be like in 5, 10, 15 years if it's this bad right now?
Yeah, well, it's a legitimate question. It's a legitimate concern. I alluded to, you know, earlier the fact that, you know, when we say this is a new normal, it's a common sort of parlance to say, well, you know, we're dealing with this new normal created by climate change. But it's worse than that, right? Because a new normal sounds like, all right, well, we've arrived in this new situation and we now have to figure out how to adapt to that situation. But that's not what's going on. It's a moving target. As we continue to warm the planet, we get even greater extremes of heat and drought and wildfires that you can't even really imagine. Based on the experiences we've had thus far, we sometimes call it a no analog world, which is to say that the extremes that we will see in 10, 20, 30 years literally have no counterpart today. We have no analog for what we will be dealing with if we continue down this road. Now, here's that's the bad news, and it conveys the urgency of acting. But there's also some good news that communicates the agency, the fact that we can do something about that. And as we better understand the underlying science of sort of the global carbon cycle and carbon emissions and how they impact the planet and the climate, we're understanding that the amount of warming that we experience is more or less a function of the amount of carbon we've burned up to this date. And that's why we have this notion of a carbon budget. A certain amount of carbon burned will elevate global temperatures a certain amount. That sounds bad, but it's actually good in the sense that we control our own destiny. If we stop burning carbon and producing carbon pollution now, global temperatures stabilize quickly, and these other impacts stabilize. So we can prevent things from getting much worse. To literally reverse them would require us to go beyond that and actually start sucking CO2 back out of the atmosphere using technology that has been proposed for that purpose. But, you know, if we stop burning carbon now, we stop warming the planet. So there is agency. We can have a very direct and immediate impact on this problem.
All right, so let's talk about that, because we've asked you many times, Professor Mann, if you were able to pass a couple policies, you know, and let's say that we've got the money and we do have the money, what would you do at this point, given how bad things are?
Yeah, it's a great question. And fortunately, you know, I don't really have to answer it based purely on my own views. I can point to proposals that are already on the table. House Democrats, Senate Democrats, and the current Democratic nominee for president, Joe Biden, all have fairly bold climate plans that are on the table, that are, you know, action ready. They can hit the ground running if in this next election we, you know, vote in politicians who will actually do something about this problem rather than politicians who have acted as apologists and advocates for the fossil fuel industry. If we turn up and we vote on the issue of climate, we can see immediate action. We can reverse the damage that's been done over the past 4 years by the Trump administration, their efforts to literally dismantle the progress on climate that had been made in the previous administration, and we can move forward. And there are a variety of sort of components of those proposals, and we'll have to hash that out. Each of the proposals is different, and so, you know, Senate and House Democrats and President would have to get together and find some, you know, compromise set of policies to move forward. But each of them has, you know, putting a price on carbon. And how we do that, you know, we can debate that. A carbon tax, revenue neutral carbon tax, tradable emissions permits, which was actually a Republican idea originally put forward by George Herbert Walker Bush to deal with acid rain. How we go about doing that, you know, there's a legitimate policy debate to be had. Introducing incentives for renewable energy, no longer green lighting, new fossil fuel projects, new pipelines, offshore oil drilling, et cetera. And introducing incentives for the public to, you know, shift their behavior in a way that's more carbon friendly. It's all of the above. We need to do all of those things. We need a comprehensive plan. And the good news is we sort of have that now. It's on the table. All we have to do is elect these politicians.
Okay, so to that point, covering climatenow.org, which is a great journalism effort, they have a piece out, "The Sitting President Has No Climate Plan. Why isn't that headline news? Trump has no plan to deal with the climate crisis. And yet it's barely being discussed in the media with only 55 days till the election."
Yeah, I actually disagree with the statement. He does have a plan to worsen the climate crisis. If we continue with his administration, and he's outsourced his environmental and climate policies to polluters, to plutocrats like the Koch brothers and the Mercers, and to fossil fuel interests. So they are actively dismantling environmental protections, not just those that were implemented under the Obama administration, but that go all the way back to the age of Nixon. And so they're actively doing damage. And the first thing we need to do is to prevent that damage. But you're absolutely right. This should be at the forefront of our political discourse right now. This is the greatest threat that we face as a civilization, an even greater crisis than the pandemic. It may play out in some sense more slowly, but it looms in the background. Even as we struggle to deal with coronavirus, we've got this larger crisis to deal with, the climate crisis. And it's been disappointing that there hasn't been nearly as much media focus. And some outlets are good and have given attention to this issue. But to a large extent, the mainstream media has not really devoted nearly enough attention to this issue, to this crisis, given that it's the greatest crisis we face in the future, and given that it actually, if you ask voters, certainly Democratic voters right now, what are the most important issues to them in the Democratic primaries, Democratic primary voters listed climate change as the top issue. The climate crisis is the top issue. And so there is this... there is this dissonance between what the public is saying, the action that they're calling out for, and the relative lack of attention that we're seeing in the mainstream media, with some important, exceptions to that.
Right, like climate covering climatenow.org. To your point, Professor Mann, yesterday, journalist Emily Atkin, who runs the Heated newsletter, pointed out that over the weekend, the New York Times, the Associated Press, and the Washington Post had three major stories about the California wildfires and no mention of the climate crisis. The New York Times ran a piece called "Extreme Heat Turns State into Furnace," and it was about how heat, fire, and toxic air are affecting us here in California, but did not mention the climate crisis.
Yeah, it would be sort of like reporting on the flood in your basement without mentioning that there was a huge break in one of your pipes. I mean, you can't fix a problem when you're unwilling to talk about the source, the cause of that problem. And, you know, with New York Times, Washington Post, I would say that their coverage has been, you know, it's been unsteady. It's been uneven. You know, many of their science and environmental journalists at both, and this is true of media organizations, other media organizations as well. They've got, you know, science and environmental journalists on staff who do write about these connections, but often they'll take a story like this and they'll give it to a, you know, a political reporter who doesn't have that context, who doesn't have that background, who isn't immersed in sort of the science discourse. And you end up getting articles that talk about one of the profound, some of the most profound and dangerous impacts of climate change that is playing out without even a mention of the fact that it's due to climate change. And you know, so to some extent, we're doing better. By and large, the media has at least moved away from the false balance that we used to see so much with climate change, where, you know, they'd have on a climate scientist or a climate expert, and then they bring on a climate change denier who's a talking head for a fossil fuel industry front group, and they would treat the topic as if it was a legitimate debate between equal sides, equal camps. Mainstream media has largely moved away from that. But they still have to do better, and you put your finger on it. They have to connect the dots. Climate change isn't just a theoretical problem in the future about polar bears. It's about the disastrous impacts that we are dealing with in real time now here in the United States in the form of unprecedented hurricanes and superstorms and floods and wildfires that are playing out, you know, impacting us where we live today.
Let's take a caller before we go to break. Let's hear from Chris in Oakland. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. I think you might have, your guest might have addressed this a little bit while I was on the phone to get on the phone. but I think it's really important part of the picture here. My question that I told the handler was, do we really have a chance? Like, do we have a chance to move out of this pattern that we're in? I feel like when the sky is going to be blue again, people are going to just, like, go back to whatever they were doing, to the buildings that are inefficient, go back to their diet that's a ton of animal agriculture, go back to driving, back to the airplanes when COVID's over. People are even going to get back on cruise ships, which I can't believe. So, like, do we really have a chance?
Yeah, well, thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for that question, Chris, because I think that's on a lot of people's minds. There is a lot of sort of doom and gloom out there in some circles, and you'd be led to think that sort of we've gone beyond the point of no return when it comes to climate action. And believe it or not, some of the forces of denial, of the forces of inaction, fossil fuel interests and those advocating for them, have to some extent promoted that narrative, the idea that it's too late to act. Because if you truly believe it's too late to do anything, that leads you down the same path of inaction as outright denial of the problem. And polluting interests understand that. And ironically, they've actually been promoting that narrative to some extent. So it's really important to understand, as I said before, you know, I don't have to tell you that there is urgency. If you're in California, you can just look out your window and you see the urgency of acting on climate. But what you might not see immediately is the agency, the fact that there is still time to avert the worst impacts of climate change. Now, you know, Chris alludes to something else. So that's sort of, so, you know, it's still physically possible to prevent a further worsening of climate change. We could take actions to reduce carbon emissions and keep carbon dioxide levels below those sort of catastrophic, those that will commit us to the most catastrophic impacts of climate change. But then the logical follow-up is, okay, well, it's possible, but do we have the will to do it? And that's where I am cautiously optimistic based on some of the developments we've seen recently, sort of tipping points, not the bad kinds of tipping points, climate tipping points, which we worry about, And there may be many looming out there, including the collapse of the ice sheets and massive sea level rise if we warm the planet enough to sort of set those changes in motion. So there are bad climate tipping points that we have to worry about, but there are good societal tipping points that we can hope for. And we've seen that in recent years on issues like marriage equality, where in a very short period of time during the Obama years, we saw a fundamental transformation in terms of public support for marriage equality. The public at large dramatically shifted their collective view about this. And there is a whole sort of social science behind tipping points and what drives them and when they happen. We've seen another tipping point. In fact, there's one playing out this year in recent months, a tipping point on issues of racial justice. And in fact, Republican pollster Frank Luntz has actually said that this is the largest shift he has ever seen in public opinion over such short a period of time. The dramatic increase in the percent of the public that recognizes that we have a real problem when it comes to matters of racial justice. And so I think we're actually nearing the point where we see a similar tipping point like transition on the issue of climate change. All of the necessary factors are starting to align. The youth climate movement, which has centered this issue on basic matters of intergenerational ethics, which is where it should be, you know, our ethical obligation not to destroy this planet for future generations, a shift, an increase in activism on issues of climate justice, much more energy in the climate movement among activists, and some favorable policy developments, including the fact that, you know, renewable energy is becoming increasingly competitive with fossil fuel energy, even without the incentives that we really would like to see to accelerate that transition. So I am cautiously optimistic, and just a gratuitous plug here. I have a book coming out called The New Climate War this January, and it's about all this. It's about the new battles that we're fighting as we move away from climate change denial. Polluting interests are still trying to prevent action by dampening enthusiasm among activists, by deflecting attention away from systemic changes towards personal behavior, make it sound like it's you and me rather than, you know, polluting companies that are responsible for this problem. And there's a whole array of sort of tactics that they're using to try to prevent action on climate. We need to recognize those tactics, fight back against them, and see that there is an opportunity for meaningful change, but only if we turn out in this next election. I've said it before, but never have I meant it more. This is a make or break election when it comes to, you know, the sort of world that we will see in the future, the world that we will leave behind for our children and grandchildren. And we need to turn out and vote in this election and vote on the issue of climate and vote for politicians who support climate action. And right now, that's just one party. That's the Democratic Party. And that's at the top of the ticket all the way, you know, from president all the way down to dog catcher. We have to keep that focus. Vote on this issue in the next election so that we get policymakers who are willing to act on our behalf rather than politicians who are simply rubber stamps for polluting interests.
Professor Mann, before we let you go, one of the arguments of the climate activists like the Sunrise Movement is that they know that they cannot push Trump, but they know that they've already pushed Biden because, according to the Sunrise Movement, his plan has gotten better. So in our remaining minutes, can you talk about the importance of that?
Yeah, and I only, you know, I barely sort of touched on that, but it was implicit in my comments. The reasons for cautious optimism are because of groups like the Sunrise Movement and Fridays for Future, sort of the youth climate movement that has, you know, really, you know, a number of things. It's recentered this conversation about ethics and morality where it needs to be, intergenerational ethics where it needs to be. But there's also this remarkable empowerment that the movement represents, reclaiming the conversation, holding, you know, politicians and opinion leaders accountable for bad behavior. All of these things. And, you know, it's easy to imagine, you know, it's very simple. They're the good guys and the bad guys, and you vote for the good guys. But it's not that simple because polluting interests have such influence. There's so much money in politics from the fossil fuel industry that they've been able to prevent, you know, action from taking place, not just by seizing control of the Republican Party, but by convincing enough Democrats to not support climate policies. And so we do need to put pressure even on politicians who, you know, are nominally on our side, because there's so much pressure coming from the other side that if there isn't an equal pushback on politicians to do the right thing, we know what's going to happen. They're just going to cave in to those powerful special interests. So, you know, Sunrise and other groups have played a really important role in keep, you know, holding their toes to the fire. And the result, you know, has been that we have some very strong policy, you know, commitments on the part of congressional Democrats and the presidential Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden, and we can make sure that they follow up. We have to hold them accountable and make sure they follow up on their campaign promises. But the first step, of course, is to vote them in.
Well, Professor Mann, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have you. Professor Michael Mann is Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State. His forthcoming book is The New Climate War. We will definitely have him on to talk about that in a few months. Coming up after a break, we will speak with Dr. Chris Dykus, Professor and Coordinator of the Wildland Fire and Fuels Management Program at Cal Poly State University. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about fires, high temperatures, extreme weather events. Scientists say that the climate crisis is making these events more likely and severe, and we are on the front lines here in California. Now I would like to welcome Dr. Chris Dykus to the show. Dr. Dykus is a professor and coordinator of the Wildland Fire and Fuels Management Program at Cal Poly. He's president of the Association for Fire Ecology and coordinator of the Wildland Urban Interface Module of the California Fire Science Consortium. Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Rose. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I was just looking at your Twitter feed and, excuse me, yesterday you wrote that three firefighters were injured, one in critical condition. I'm so sorry to hear this. How are firefighters doing overall?
Well, they're stretched to the absolute limit at the moment. We've had so many fires occurring simultaneously. It's just we don't have people able to show up. And then we also have restrictions regarding COVID that's kind of putting a damper on things. And these people are just absolutely exhausted, that they're putting themselves in, you know, harm's way, you know, to kind of protect us, protect our environment. And they're really, really struggling out there right now because there's not enough people, not enough equipment to go around. And that's part of the reason that we're seeing such large fires at this moment.
So not enough people and not enough equipment. What changes are needed?
Well, it's a really, really complex issue. You know, on a normal bad day, we can satisfy the needs, you know, for suppression equipment and the personnel to come through. But with the lightning strike that we had a couple weeks ago, you know, following a previous heat wave that we had, it's just overly taxed the personnel. We just don't have enough. We have people coming from all over the country, and we've got people coming from Canada, Australia, and other places, but it's still just not enough because these fires at this point are so big and there's so many of them. And because of that, several of the fires, they're just allowing some of them just to be able to kind of burn freely because we just don't have the people to kind of put suppression resources on those.
Wow. Chris, it makes me think that, you know, we've been doing shows about this for so long, and every single guest has always said, this is our new norm and it's only going to get worse. So what are the conversations, amongst the fire chiefs and the people who make these decisions?
Well, honestly, I get a little bit aggravated with the idea about this being the new norm, because this is kind of what we're seeing today is sort of the product of the sins of the past. It's not just something that happens overnight, but everything we've mentioned, you know, we've heard about climate change, but also lack of forest management. Fire suppression has played a role of it. We have all these fuels that have been growing up, and then all it's ready to take is some sort of ignition source. whether that be the lightning bus that came through a couple of weeks ago, whether it be an inerrant campfire, whether that be when the high winds, Diablo winds start blowing, you know, where we have electrical equipment come through. Everything is primed and ready to go, and it's just waiting for a spark. And so it's a really scary thing. But it's something that I'm optimistic if we have the political will to kind of tackle each of these elements. And it's not just one single element that's causing all these things, that we can work our way out of it. But it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be cheap.
All right, we'll talk about that in a minute. But I want to ask you, what is causing these fires at this point? We know that the lightning that happened a couple of weeks ago started a lot of fires. But at this point, what percentage are caused by humans? And then what's the other percentage?
Well, in California, by far, over 90% of the wildfires are started by some sort of human action, whether that be the power lines, which have caused some of the major fires we've seen recently. Ignitions via cars on the side of the roads, like the car fire that we all looked at with just in awe and shock, where, you know, we had this fire whirl that took out parts of Reading. You know, that was started by just a couple. They had a flat, and then they pulled over on the side of the road in their overheated car, then started a fire that then wiped out a large part of Reading and destroyed a big part of the Whiskey Town recreation area in that part of the world.
Oh, so sad. And then this got national, international news, this baby gender reveal party that happened. And, you know, people were camping, and it was near Yucaipa. Is that how you say it? Yucaipa, California? And, I mean, people had to be airlifted out of this area. I mean, it was so, so scary to watch. They had to jump in the river to try to avoid the flames. I'm sorry,
well,
jumping in the lake.
Well, if I came close to having to do that myself just this last Saturday, I got out by the hair of my chinny-chin-chin from the creek fire burning over near Shaver Lake. And it was just amazing to watch. You know, I've been doing this sort of thing for 30 years, and it just astounded me how quickly this fire grew and just blew out. And at the time, there was zero warning, and it's just my wildfire spider senses started getting off, and I have a breathing-impaired wife, and it's like I had to get down the mountain. And we made it with about 30 minutes to spare. And if not, I was going to have to head back on a one-lane road that you need four-wheel drive to go back to a dry lake bed up at Lake Edison and shelter there, much like the poor people at Mammoth Pools who were evacuated via the Chinook helicopters.
Right. And it's not just California. We're talking Nevada, Arizona, Oregon, Washington. They had also evacuation orders just like we have here in California.
Oh, we have. You know, it's a scary time, you know, and to be out there. The conditions are ripe, whether that be the fuels or the weather or different things, to be able to kind of exacerbate an already bad problem that we have. And there's very, very little time, very little warning, you know, regarding these evacuations. And people, they get put in harm's way very, very quickly, and they have to act. And sometimes, you know, it adds to injury. And unfortunately, we've seen increasing fatalities in California and the United States via wildfire burnovers in the last several years.
Well, you definitely should opt into Nixl if you haven't already, because Nixl provides you with local public safety information. You can text your zip code to 888-777. Again, text your zip code to 888-777, and then you will get alerts from your local agencies. Really important information there. Chris, you talked about, you know, not having enough people, not having enough equipment, fire suppression, fuels that have been growing, and you said it'll take political will to tackle all of this. So as I asked Michael Mann, you know, what was at the top of his list, what are some of the major changes you would like to see?
Well, some of the major changes I would like to see would include an easing of the regulatory environment in order to get out some of these dangerous fuels that have been growing up. You know, I mentioned lack of fire suppression. Well, the suppression is actually adding to part of the problem over the years, in that where so many ecosystems within California, you know, they're critical that they have to have sort of these normal, steady pulses of fire. And we've gotten really, really good at putting out these fires under a normal bad day. And just when it just gets the extreme weather, extreme events, you know, that's when they get away. So one of the things I've been really encouraged by watching the governor and the legislature is that there have been a tremendous amount of effort going into reducing the hazardous fuels in our forest lands, in our shrublands, and also in our local communities. Being able to get in and take away the materials that are going to be able to fuel these wildfires.
How are you thinking about this, Chris? Because at this point, we don't have any action from the Trump administration or the Republicans. In fact, Michael Mann said, I mean, they're just making the crisis worse. So if you do not have any action from the federal government, and if they're making the crisis even worse, how do you see this playing out? Because that makes action at the state level even more important. But it's not like what happens here doesn't affect other states and vice versa.
Oh, definitely. You know, some of the things that has certainly been called for by the current presidential administration is there has been sort of a call to be able to better manage our forest lands on, you know, our public lands, our national and our federal lands. And this has been kind of encouraging to me because, unfortunately, I feel so sorry for the Forest Service because they're kind of stuck in a situation where they know that there's a problem, but it doesn't matter what they choose to do. You know, really good people doing good work, they're going to get sued. And it's going to be a lot of the management that they've got trying to reduce the fire problem is get sued in some way because no one likes the specific way in which they might be going about it. You know, to try to reduce these fuels. And so, you know, we have so many public federal lands in our state and across the West, and that a lot of places it's almost kind of like a no-touch zone. And, you know, these lands that are out there, historically, they were touched a lot via indigenous burning and indigenous burning practices. And so we can't just go back right now. It's like, oh, well, let's just go set a bunch of prescribed fires like the indigenous peoples in California did wonderfully, because at this point it's not the same. We've got such this amazing fuel buildup that's out there that we need to get into some sort of mechanical treatment, working, you know, with some type of mechanical treatment to get those volatile fuels out of the forest. And it's a tough situation on our federal lands, but it's getting a little bit better on the state lands, and I hope that we can continue doing it, because the fuel is just one part of the issue, but that's something that I'm encouraged to see that we're starting to address in a more proactive manner.
The state is teaming up with Native tribes on this issue, right, to deal with this?
As far as I've seen, yeah. So there are some different First Nations that are really working hard, been doing a lot of things, and have a lot of great knowledge that have been implemented for a long, long time. And part of the reason that we're seeing some of the issues that we have of today is that, you know, the decisions were made back, 100 plus years ago that we're going to take away that indigenous burning. So I look at some of the tribes like the Yurok Nation up in Northern California. They've been incredibly proactive at trying to manage their forests from these indigenous forest practices, which involve putting fire on the land, which is necessary and critical for so many ecosystems in California.
Right. Well, we're definitely going to do a show about that in the coming weeks. What are your thoughts about where we are right now? Are we beyond the point of mitigating these extremes and what we're dealing with, or are we at the point of adapting to them? How are you thinking about that?
Well, you know, for myself and for a lot of others, it's like, okay, well, how can we make our wildlands more resilient to fire? It's not that, you know, people are like, they look at fire as the boogeyman, and we see the what we refer to as CNN drops, you know, where they've got the large planes dumping the fire retardant on the fires, and it's like, oh my gosh, it's scary. But the right type of fire in the right type of place, it does an amazing job in not only reducing the future fire risk, but also has innumerable amounts of benefits to the ecosystem and, frankly, to people. We've seen that You know, as we implement this, though, it's tough. It can be expensive. It's certainly much more expensive to fight a wildfire than it is to go through with a prescribed burn. But, you know, we do this and we know that it works. But besides just the expense and the danger that kind of comes in with it with a chance of escape is that smoke goes somewhere. And, you know, you've got 35 million plus people living in California that, you know, you can be impacted by fires being hundreds of miles away. And I know you're experiencing this right now in the Bay Area.
Right. Yes, we are. In fact, it's still dark and the sky is this eerie orange-red color. Chris, as you know, there are 2 million acres have already been burned in California. And we have a question from Laura who says, do those millions of acres help with future fires?
They can, actually. In fact, I was on a discussion yesterday with some of the leadership within the California Fire Science Consortium, and we're talking about that this has an opportunity as a way to start implementing some of these prescribed fire treatments we say that we're wanting to get, because you need a safe zone in which to kind of what we refer to as anchoring the fire. So now you have a recently burned fire that came through, and it's blackened, so it's not going to burn again immediately. So we can use those as anchor points to safely put in some of these prescribed burns. But, you know, we can't just walk away and say, hey, look at us, we did this, you know, we did this amazing treatment, whether it be via prescribed fire or mechanical treatment, because amazingly, this vegetation grows back. So it's not just a one step where you come through and shake your, you know, everyone shakes their hands and way to go, you know, because the things will grow back, and it has to be this continuous process across the landscapes to be able to reduce that risk on a landscape level.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm going to go back out in my front yard where it looks like it almost snowed on me because of all the ash that's fallen from the Dolan fire up in the Big Sur area.
Well, stay safe out there, and thanks to you and all the firefighters who are working 24/7 on this.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Ruth.
Thank you. Dr. Chris Dykus is a professor and coordinator of the Wildland Fire and Fuels Management Program at Cal Poly. He's president of the Association for Fire Ecology and coordinator of the Wildland Urban Interface Module of the California Fire Science Consortium. You can find more resources at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.